Just gonna go for it.
Do it.
From deep in the wilds of Pittsfield Township, Michigan, it's the Grace and Paul Pottscast. She's a left-wing conservative Catholic homeschooler who loves to garden. He's a bearded computer geek who reads and writes like he's running out of time. Together, they're raising an ever-growing army of adorkable children and planning the revolution. So,
yeah.
Good week.
You know, I've had better.
We missed a podcast.
Yeah.
Because we were just so wiped out and overloaded last weekend.
Yeah.
And this weekend, I had a bad allergy attack, just like wiped out by hay fever and, you know.
All that stuff, yeah.
And so I've had to dope myself up with massive amounts of antihistamines again. It kind of hit me by surprise and just like set off. Yeah, so I've been feeling terrible. But I cleaned the oven.
Yay!
And
I had a few days where I was really just whacked.
Yeah.
Like I'd basically eaten some things off plan.
Off your healthy food list.
Yeah, and it really kicked my ass.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was miserable for like a couple of days. I just had to like, you know, guys, I'm not available. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. No, to the kids, you mean.
Yeah.
Just go raise yourselves.
Go raise yourselves. Go play amongst yourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. Fortunately, with like a large lot and woods and the older kids and the younger kids,
they can safely play amongst
themselves. They actually can
right.
do that. They can go play in the woods and do sword fights and whatever.
And, yeah. And come to me as needed.
Yeah.
So that was, I was glad to have that.
And yeah, and then this
escape hatch.
This week I had like a really productive work week, but everything else feels like hell.
Yeah, it just isn't moving and doing anything.
We're still in this.
Still in Saginaw hell with the goddamn house.
we're still going through this process of trying to figure out what's the best worst option, the least worst option.
The least worst. Yeah.
And the house.
None of the solutions are good.
No. I mean, none of them are going to. It's you know, I think we've talked about this, but it's. We're not even hoping to get back what we put into the house.
No,
and,
not by a long shot.
You know, and that would be like the normal thing that was sort of supposed to happen. Mm. And then we're not even hoping to like get out of it what we currently owe.
No.
Which would still require us to pay like for this, the commissions and selling fees and whatnot.
Yeah.
At this point, we're trying to figure out how much we can, like...
Afford to lose
to sell it.
Yes. How much debt can we take on to sell the house?
More debt.
Right.
So, like, what size of a loan can I take just to be able to bring enough cash to closing to get this thing off our backs?
Yeah.
And it's not good.
That's not pretty.
We're also considering... possibly leasing the house.
Like a lease with a purchase option.
But I would still have to borrow $6,000 or $7,000 because I want us to put two furnaces
in. Yeah, to replace the furnaces. So yeah, this house is so big it has two furnaces.
Yeah, and we tried to get an estimate for combining the furnaces into one.
And
they just tell us, you can't even do it. Like
you're talking about a commercial system.
You would need to buy a furnace that's made for like an office building or something.
Right.
And it would be very, very expensive to run.
To run and to retool. Right.
Yeah. And the house isn't designed for that kind of ducting, so...
You have to redo the ductwork.
It will be super...
Inefficient.
Inefficient because it's not tight like a modern office building.
Precisely. And actually, this last estimate was the first time someone...
explained it
like
to
walked
you.
Me through it like so why is this a bad option
right we've talked to try to talk to people about it before and they just this guy you had out actually like laid it out for
laid
you
out.
Why
no this is not,
why
this
it's
won't
not going to work
right I mean you could do this it would cost you $15,000 and you could do this but it would and be even more expensive
the
to
monthly
run the
bill would be even higher
than running two conventional house furnaces
right
so there it is
so what we really are wanting to do is replace both furnaces.
Yeah, because one of them technically still runs and actually has not set off the carbon monoxide detectors even once.
Well, yes.
But it's...
It's really old, and it's really damaged.
It's a 40-year-old furnace.
Right.
I think it was installed in 1978.
Something like that.
Yeah. And it still runs.
The previous one. There are two. That's weird.
So there's two, right.
In the crawl space, there's an old dead one, and then there's the
current
one.
From, like, 1960.
One. Yeah.
There's the one from 1978.
Yeah.
And which seems to have lasted about 40 years.
Right. And that's way beyond the shelf life.
The shelf life, right. I mean, it's like an extra 20 years of service.
Right. So what we're wanting to do is actually put a third furnace in there.
Right. And part of what the quote was for the reason it's more expensive
is to remove the two old furnaces,
put a new one in, and then the newer furnace in the larger space, which...
We can get a more efficient one.
We can get an even more efficient one. We can get more efficient ones of both, actually.
Yeah. And that actually might result in lower energy bills together with the attic rework. But we don't really know because we haven't tried to take the house through a winter with these changes in it yet.
And then, and this is an ongoing unresolved issue because the insurance company can go to hell.
They still owe us money.
And
the company that cleaned the ducts didn't.
Yeah.
That was exciting to find out. We thought they had done it, and they called us and said...
Oops.
Well, no, they called you because the guy was like at the property.
Wanted to try and get back in, and we changed the
lockbox. A month after we thought this work had been done.
Two months after
we thought this was all done, and we paid for it.
It was kind of appalling. To be honest. Yeah.
And like, okay. And, you know, we could stomp our feet and shake our fists and like say, get our attorney.
And shout out some clouds.
Yeah, shout out clouds. Or like threaten them to, we could like tell our credit card company to reverse that charge, or we could get our attorney to call them or something.
But there's no point.
We just want to get the damn work done.
We just want the work done. It has been an ongoing problem, an ongoing thing. Oh, but I wasn't done with the insurance company.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Because they still owe us money.
They still owe us $1,700 or so.
And
we're really scraping the bottom of the barrel to pay off the guys who did the paint and plaster work because we were counting on getting this reimbursement.
Right.
So they've
been turning around so fast before. Right.
Yeah. So they've been very patient because they haven't come after us, but they've allowed us to pay over a period of a few months because, you know, they're getting paid.
They're getting paid. They know us.
But
they know we're good for it eventually. But
it's leaving our accounts dangerously low. It was not easy to come up with an extra $3,500 over the last, over these few months. Right.
Yeah, that wasn't budgeted for. Right. I mean, because I think we'd only budget it for our deductibles.
Right.
Right?
Right. So.
And... There's this ongoing thing, I think I've mentioned it before, with the furnace.
Yeah.
Where their claim is that...
Oh, the bats didn't burn it out, didn't cause it to overheat and crack the heat exchanger.
It's a 13-year-old furnace.
And their claim was, it's just end of life.
It's just the end of its life. And they said the clogged filter may have contributed to it.
Right.
And I'm thinking, dude... You know what the filter was clogged with?
If you looked in the furnace, you saw a dead bat, at least one.
Yes, clogging the filter,
like stuck in there.
So and if you think the filter clogged...
I believe that slowed down the airflow enough to cause the heat exchanger to overheat and crack.
Right, because...
But, you know, who am I?
What do we know? Anyway...
But yeah, the filter was dirty, right?
Well, and it was also full of bats.
And
just dirty and full of bats.
Right.
So I'm just saying.
So their claim is that, well, this wasn't related to the bats.
So that's not their responsibility.
So they don't want to cover the furnace. So like, okay, so...
Yeah, fine.
So basically it's like any money we're considering putting into the house...
It's just gone.
We know and have put in for these repairs. We know we're not going to see any of it back.
Right.
We're just trying to see, okay, if putting this money in... will somehow allow us to move on to that next least bad option somehow.
Right. Allow us to get rid of the house.
Right.
Right.
Either to sell it or lease it and kick the can. And leasing it is just going to kick the can down the road.
Because you still have to go through this process of somehow selling it.
In 3 years.
Three to 5 years.
Yeah. Right.
depending on the length of the lease
term. And that's like best case. And, you know, the lease could also go bad. You know, someone someone could fail to make payments, and then we're kind of
on the hook,
screwed all over again. Anyway, it's all fun.
So that's been like, I don't know, weighing on us this week because we have to make a decision soon.
Yeah. How we're going to get the house through the winter.
Right.
Yeah. And that so it is coming to a deadline kind of, which is really like the first hard freeze, you know. Mm-hmm. So,
and I think we have to figure out a solution by October
well before 1st. Then.
Right, we have to have something in mind.
Yeah.
I think by October 1st.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
And then you know we can't even like, we're not ready to heat this house. We're still running our AC around the clock.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Because the heat is really lingering. This summer.
Yeah.
And we also, our heating system was leaking water all over the floor of the...
Yeah, we need to have someone look at that.
So somebody has to come. So it needs to be like, I think we need to have a couple of valves replaced or repacked or whatever they
something
do with
like
these
that. Whatever they do
faucets.
With boilers.
And then we have to have the thing like flushed and refilled with fresh water.
Right.
And tested.
Yeah.
And that's not in the budget because we're paying all this thousands of dollars
for the
paint and plaster repair.
And did all the like miscellany related to the old house. And there's just a lot of miscellany.
Right.
That wasn't.
And we had to pay for that because we exceeded our insurance coverage.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. The mold was beyond their coverage.
Water and mold damage.
Right. Which I'm like, how much would more water and mold coverage cost?
Right.
Because maybe we want it. You know?
Well, I don't think we can pay for it retroactively.
Oh, well, no. But like
Going forward. On this house.
Yeah. On this house and going forward. Maybe we want that coverage. And maybe, you know, how much? I mean, really, what are we talking?
Yeah.
But I don't think we want it from them.
No. We would like to change insurance companies.
Which it really...
When we're all done with this.
Yeah. Like we want to put all this to bed first. But
yeah.
It's a real disappointment because I was happy to buy from a mutual. You know what I mean?
Right, right. But no, they've been very hard to work with, and we've been very unsatisfied with.
And the one claim that was working is now gone south. So, here we are.
So we've also been following Hurricane Florence with some trepidation.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends. You got some family down there?
You've got friends. I've got family. My aunt and uncle live in Myrtle Beach.
I mean, they're my family too, but you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
Right.
But fortunately, I heard from my cousin, their oldest daughter, who took them to D.C.,
which is its own kind of suffering, but
but they're out of the
they're out of the
people are out of the path of the storm,
which is good.
Their house, we really don't know, but I mean, I
it's anybody's guess with the house.
I don't know if their whole they're about 7 miles from the Atlantic in Myrtle Beach. It's not very far, and they have a small inland like creek running through their development through their yard. And I think I know that in past storms, the water has come up to within a few feet of their front door.
Yeah.
So I've got to assume that their house is probably flooded. I doubt if, because Myrtle Beach wasn't on the highest wind zone, I don't think that, you know, probably it did a lot of wind damage to their home.
Oh, maybe.
But my guess is that it's probably flooded.
Certainly. I've seen pictures from Fort Mill, which is further inland.
Yeah.
And they've had a lot of down trees.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's true. They could have trees down too.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I also know that like power was out for that whole region. So, I mean, if they had stayed, I think they would have been looking at trying to survive like at least a week and probably more with no power. In a zone where they can't travel around. Right. Mm-hmm. So we're watching that situation, and unfortunately, and quite a few people have been killed already.
Yeah.
And I got into a snit on Twitter with a Pennsylvania representative, a guy who was talking about basically how these reports of how this was such a dangerous storm were fake news because, oh, look, it's already fake only news, a category news. One. Huh. We're like, dude.
People's lives are at risk.
Okay? People's lives are at risk, and the category actually only amounts to describing the wind speed.
The wind speed, right.
Right, and, you know, some of the most devastating storms in recent memory were either Category 1 or had degenerated into a tropical storm wind by the time they did most of their damage.
I think Sandy, wasn't Sandy a Category 1?
A 1.
Yeah.
Like, went from a 2 to a 1.
And then...
And Harvey, which flooded Texas with like 50 inches of rain, which is just an unfathomable amount of rain, like trillions of gallons of rain, you know, was a tropical storm when it did that.
50 inches. So that's like 4 feet of water.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot of water.
It's a lot of water.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's trillions, but I think it's billions.
It's,
You gonna go for trillions?
I remember reading up on, like, trying to calculate the volume of water involved, and it was...
Staggering.
It was a number that you couldn't wrap your head around.
Right, it was a staggering amount. Yeah. Right. So
it's enough to change the it's enough water to change the geography, like to change the pressure on the continental plates and cause geographic changes, causes land to rise and fall, cause like volcanoes to happen on the other side of the world, you know, like
good grief almighty.
It's just staggering.
A staggering amount of water.
Yeah. And it changes the rotation of the earth a little bit to redistribute
that much water. Yeah. See, I really feel like the climate change things is a we don't really know what we've gotten into.
Of course not.
Like we don't fully understand what we've gotten into. Well, and here's the thing I was about to say about Sandy.
Yeah.
New Jersey is still recovering from Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah, sure.
Which was a Category 1, and there are places that are still in shambles.
Sure.
How many years ago was that?
Yeah.
You know. So it's a Category 1 hurricane is not a trivial thing.
No, and the modern risk has been that these storms that don't have such huge winds, because of this climate amplification, they're carrying far more water
and heat
heat, and they're far bigger, like wider, cover a larger area than
this is multi-state. This is like South Carolina, the Carolinas, and Virginia.
It sort of depends on how you define the boundaries of the storm. The storm itself, like the eye of it, was not
that didn't cover three
huge.
States.
No, it's a couple miles across, but it's passed along the coast, and it was moving. That's another part of the problem. If the system is dropping all this rain, and it's moving extremely slowly, was like 6 miles an hour or something. It's moving really slowly. It has
system.
days to drop amazing amounts of rain, and it was moving sort of southwest, and now it's sort of turned a little west, and it's going further inland, and eventually it'll blow through Michigan, you know, what's left of
what's left of
it, but or you know, maybe further east, I don't know, it's hard to predict that far out, but the system is baffling me a little bit, because it's pulling in these rain bands behind it, and it's like you expect that once it's over land,
we lose some steam.
Basically, it's like a fire,
right?
It's sort of a chemical. It's a physical process, sort of analogous to a chemical process, where you have energy transferred, and over the ocean, the warm ocean, you have this energy transfer happening. It basically is a process that
sucks.
Yeah, energy. Sucks heat. Redistributes heat from the ocean through this vortex that happens, right? Once it is over land, you would expect that it would slow down.
Cool down.
It would dissipate. But
it does slow down.
Yeah.
But
due to friction with like...
Right. But I don't see them dissipate.
It doesn't...
They have to burn it. It has to burn itself out.
Yeah. But... Yeah, because the land shouldn't be giving off as much, you know, warm, wet air as the ocean was.
Ideally.
But yeah, the meteorologists who have been reading, who are talking about this, said the scale of this and like the behavior of it moving this slowly is kind of unprecedented, you know? Mm-hmm. And so they're saying, yeah, it's going to come ashore as a category 2 and weaken rapidly, mm-hmm. but this is going to drop record amounts of rain. And
I thought I heard it described as 7 months of rain in 3 days.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that, or, you know, a year's worth of rain.
Yeah.
It's far more rain than
any
infrastructure is built for.
Right. Then the land can handle it, can run off safely. So
are we having 100-year storms every year now?
It is a 100-year storm. It's not every year, but it's but getting there every few years.
We have another 100-year storm.
Yeah. No.
It's kind of absurd.
It is absurd. And I was so angry at this guy because for him to be downplaying the severity of it based entirely on the category, mm-hmm. like, dude, you should resign your position. You're a hazard to your constituents and anyone who might trust you as an authority figure. This is, you know, you're this kind of rhetoric gets people killed.
Yeah. Although, this is the thing I was trying to say about the fake news gambit, right?
Yeah.
And the untrustworthy media.
Yeah.
We've been saying on the left for a very long time now mm-hmm. that the media is not trustworthy.
Right, right.
I mean, so it's really hard to push back against someone using that framing.
Right. And as I'm saying this, there's a video clip circulating online.
Oh God, yes.
Of a weatherman standing like in a, what's that coat called?
Like a windbreaker.
Like a windbreaker. Like he's leaning and rocking and like trying to make it look as dramatic as possible, right. As if he's literally having a hard time
standing
right. in, you know, what really at the time were only like 35 mile an hour winds, right?
And behind him,
he's literally trying to make it look as dramatic as possible,
right?
And then from a different camera angle behind him, a couple of guys in shorts are sort of nonchalantly strolling through a parking lot to their car, and I've invented some dialogue for them. It's like, so you want to go see if the Waffle House is open?
Yeah, let's go. I mean, there's nothing going on.
And it's windy.
It's windy. You can see their coats flapping in the wind.
Yeah, it's windy.
But they're literally strolling.
And the other thing you notice is that the guy's leaning into the wind. If you look at the grass and the plants and the trees and whatnot, he's leaning the wrong way.
The wind's blowing the other way, bro.
Like, yeah. So, we should trust the media and the news, right? Right? We should trust the Weather Channel to tell us what's happening. Well, yes and no. Pick your favorite meteorologist and maybe trust that person, but don't trust the hype.
And I think that's why it's hard to push back against this guy in Pennsylvania, is because with that frame...
Right.
In the context of reality.
Right.
He's got a point. Like, what are these people?
He does have a point. Right. But it's still, you can't tell people, no, this storm is not dangerous. And calling it dangerous is fake news. That's
where it crosses the line. But there is this real thing. Yeah. And that's the way you kind of like lob these things out there into the zeitgeist and get sort of like energy moving around these ideas.
Yeah.
You have to start with the kernel of truth.
Right.
And the kernel of truth is that the media is not trustworthy and hasn't been for a long time.
No. And even if they're not literally telling lies like this weatherman, this correspondent, certainly they're exaggerating everything.
They're exaggerating.
That's just how it's done.
And that was my big thing with the, op-ed or the editorial, the anonymous editorial.
Yeah.
This was the New York Times actually creating news.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, they're supposed to report the news.
Yes.
They're not supposed to generate the news.
No, this was a real... I mean, you know, the news cycle is so hypercharged recently that this is already kind of out of the news cycle a little bit.
Right. But I don't want to forget this.
This media frenzy and this... I'm with the resistance working inside the Trump administration, you know... It's like, who exactly is trolling who and for what ends?
Right. And it really, everyone's worried about the content and who this guy is and and what it represents and all this meta stuff.
Yeah, everyone...
No, really, the problem is that the New York Times would print this.
Everyone was on like 1A on the NPR morning show was arguing about their favorite theory of who is this mysterious resistance figure? Like, fuck. Sorry, excuse me. Like, yeah. Fuck everything about this, honestly.
No, really, really. And so this is the New York Times making an editorial decision...
To make news. Yeah.
And that is not their job. Right. And that's a fundamental violation of their journalistic integrity.
And, you know, I guess it's... I can see legitimate cases for them running an op-ed from a person who's in a sensitive position, like a dissident or something, you know, in Burma or in wherever, in Venezuela. So, you know, I'm not going to say there's never a case to be made for an anonymous op-ed. But I am going to say that, yeah, I'm going to say this wasn't it.
This wasn't
right.
It. Well, no, here's the thing. The dissident in Burma
talks
to a journalist who writes a story.
Right.
And says, I cannot reveal the names of my sources.
Yeah.
My sources for these reasons.
It's not really an op-ed.
Yeah. It's not really an op-ed. Yeah. It doesn't go in that context.
Right.
That's not the part of the paper where it belongs. And so
right.
a journalist can do that. And there's a context for that.
Yeah.
There's a place for that.
And so what is this you know, deep throat within the Trump administration?
Please.
What is this person risking?
Because right? when they write an op-ed, there's no mediator, as in a journalist, who says, I've verified
some of the facts of this story. Right.
So this op-ed writer can just make it up.
Right.
And then they just print it, and then they cash in.
Right.
That's... not journalism. That's making. That's creating and manufacturing
yeah.
news.
This all this happened like just a day or two after, or in the same week, I think, as this like New Yorker Festival of Ideas, or that where they were going to have Steve Bannon on stage debating. You know.
Yeah.
And it's
happened to No Platform?
That got a lot of push. It actually, a lot of that argument took place on Twitter.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to watch it hash out because they did back down.
Mm-hmm.
And,
because really, I'm pretty firm about a no platform for fascists.
But the idea that, like, oh, he has interesting things today, let's defeat him in the marketplace of ideas, you know. I mean, first of all, he's no longer, at the time when this was happening, he's been out of the public eye. He's not a thing anymore. He doesn't have a position in the administration. He doesn't, you know, have anything interesting to bring to the table, right? And that's been amply demonstrated.
Precisely. And he only has something interesting to bring if we give it to him.
If we give it to him and his, and, you know, this is just basically an opportunity to rehabilitate his career as a bomb thrower, you know.
Right. And there's no reason for us to do that. There's no reason for us to do that.
There's no sense in which he could be considered to have such somehow sterling intellectual qualifications or such radical interesting ideas that there's really a... an important case that we need to hear
right.
from him.
No, he's setting up some kind of alt-right thing in Italy, in Rome,
yeah,
near the Vatican and whatnot. Right. So I think there's this sort of, you know, these folks at think tanks are kind of dangerous.
Yes.
Or at least they can be.
Yeah.
And I think he's in that space. And I think the less traffic his ideas get,
right.
that really just kind of eliminates that. Danger
right.
from him
right.
is to stop trafficking in his ideas
right.
because he's not in a position to do anything except influence people with his ideas.
Yes.
So,
and you know, the fact that the New Yorker won't give him a time on stage and some kind of big public program.
Yeah.
That's not censorship.
That's not censorship. No.
That's not a First Amendment issue.
I mean, they won't give me time on the stage.
Right.
So,
Lord knows I've tried.
Right, so, you know,
he can publish a stupid Google blog the same way that I do.
All the time, all he wants.
You
know, he's got followers. They'll probably pass it around amongst themselves.
Yeah.
And I've noticed this is a thing, and it's been a thing for a while, right? And it's a trick. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Oh, he can have a YouTube. Well, they might throw him off.
They might throw him off YouTube. But no, this is a trick. This is the trick.
Right.
So I had literally never heard of Eminem. I'd never heard of him. I didn't know
until when?
Well, until there was this big flap where Elton John was going to perform with him.
Oh, right? Okay. Yeah. That was 20 years ago.
That was 20 years ago. Right. But he was a big name then.
Yeah.
Like everyone had heard of him. I hadn't heard of him.
Because I knew his music, and I have 3 Eminem CDs.
Right? So, you know, you'd heard of him, you knew who he was, et cetera. Yeah. I'd never heard of him, yeah. Right? Like at all.
Yeah. I unquestioningly support him. He's kind of a disturbing character.
Oh yeah.
But he had some really cool music.
Well, he had some good music and you know, he's a white guy that's performed in the Detroit music scene
right.
for his entire career.
Right.
Somehow he's never managed to use the N-word. I don't know what that's about.
Yeah.
It's like a gift or something. I don't know. But that aside, so he's going to do this thing with Elton John. And it's an outrage because he's some kind of a homophobe.
He
right?
is a homophobe, yeah.
And
he's a misogynist, you know.
Right? And so, oh my God, Elton John's going to perform with him. I got 3 emails about this guy from people I know.
Because we're teaching the controversy.
Right? So suddenly, this person I've never heard of.
Yeah.
Now I know about him. I'm like, so maybe I should listen to his music. And figure out what's going on.
Well, I think
right?
I think if he's a best-selling artist, he should be performing on the Grammys, you know, like.
So, you know.
But.
That's another question for another time. Yeah. But no, here's the trick.
Yeah.
You engage in controversy.
Right.
So that people that have not heard about you mm-hmm. hear about you.
Right.
Because people will talk about the controversy, whatever the controversy is. With people who are concerned about the or you would expect to be concerned about the controversy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So that's actually a specific strategy.
Yes.
So.
True. Yeah, your publicist will work that out for you.
We'll work that strategy out. So if you want a story about Steve Bannon in front of eyeballs on my page.
Yes.
Right? Steve Bannon does something controversial and troubling that's going to own the libs or whatever.
Yeah.
Your framing is, right?
Sure.
And then all my friends freak out and share it with me.
Right.
And this was happening 20 years ago before any social media. This was a thing. This is a way to move your message, right? To people who haven't seen it. So his goal is to get it in front of receptive eyeballs that maybe haven't looked in his corner of the world before.
Right.
And he finds that by finding my page and people who know me and people who have looked at him or know about him and been like, hell no. You have to move your message in front of those people.
You're talking about Bannon.
Bannon. This is anybody who wants to advance their idea. So during the election and even now, mm-hmm. a lot of this stuff that's like, oh my God. Did you know that Steve Bannon's doing this thing?
Right. There are an awful lot of people who just retweet. Well, you know, I say that. I retweet a lot of stuff.
Oh my God, right?
But I don't usually have an oh my God reaction. And I try not to share things that are just hype.
Right.
But I try to share interesting bits. Well,
and all those things are, the horror.
Yeah. Oh, the horror. Well, then talking about them too.
And then, talking about it, right? So,
and
the only function that serves is that anybody on my feed that maybe didn't know that Steve Bannon was doing this, now they know, and maybe they're interested.
Right. No, these things, like this op-ed and like mm-hmm. the Bannon thing, really the best way to think about them, as far as I'm concerned, is that they are literally psyops.
Literally.
Yeah.
It's literally a psyop. Yeah. And so that's why I share all kinds of things. I share lots of things. And the point of it is for discussion and whatnot.
Right.
But I prefer to share things from not from mass media per se.
Right. Major media outlets.
Yeah. I mean, I still do share. I share things in the Times and so on. But I'm very selective about it for that reason.
I tend to.
Because its function.
On Twitter, I tend to share things from individuals who are writing who are using Twitter as a platform.
Generally, individuals aren't sophisticated enough to run a PSYOP or connected enough to run a PSYOP.
Mm-hmm.
They may want to, but they just aren't sophisticated or connected
enough. I keep trying to start a cult.
It hasn't taken off yet.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's what's happening, and that's the trick. And it's a very basic trick.
Yeah.
Right? And then suddenly you're like horrified by this horrible thing that Steve Bannon is doing, and I have to tell everybody, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Now they all know, and they're going to tell all their friends. And in that circle, there's maybe one person, but he knows other people.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know what? I know exactly the five people that would be interested in this. And right. That's all they're looking for. That's the whole point of this, and is to gather those people into one place.
And this is actually how fascist ideas are spread.
Precisely how they're spread.
And how they recruit and start to get people sympathetic to their causes.
And develop sympathy, right? Yeah. So
that's really,
why it's so, this no platforming is critical.
And this is, we talked about this reading Antifa and the Everyday Antifa, Everyday Anti-Fascism techniques and whatnot.
So you know,
you really should think hard when you're sharing things on social media. Am I just spreading...
Am I doing controversy for
a fascist?
Right. Am I just doing advertising for a fascist?
Yeah.
You might be. You really might be. Right. And that's how a lot of liberals end up functioning with all their rage tweeting and rage posting about the horrible things the administration's doing.
And all the stuff about the Russian... I really can't see it as anything but a psyop. No.
Yes. Yeah.
And I don't share.
I would just like credit for calling it very early on. I just want credit for that. That's all.
Because there just is still, and you know, I'm pleased. Like I follow the Mueller investigation, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm pleased that Manafort is pleaded guilty or all these things. I'm pleased with these things that some people are going to jail, some people are being fined and whatnot. But I just don't see.
It's kind of a big so what.
It's a nice thing. It does sort of indirectly discredit this administration chip by chip, but it's not setting up any kind of overturning or prosecution of anyone that really matters.
I got a quibble with that though.
Yeah.
That presupposes that this administration had any credibility to begin with.
Well, okay. Yes.
I mean, like, seriously, but we need to discredit it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's true. Because you know, like the fact that Reagan's administration had more convicted criminals in it than any other administration in history. It was like, what was the final tally? Like 230 or like something
hundreds
like that.
Of criminals, right?
Yeah, people actually convicted of felonies doesn't change people's opinion of those golden glory days of Reagan and the Gipper, the noble Gipper, strides
the
land like a colossus.
So there's the Dem faithful and the Republican converts and the resistance, right?
Yes.
The Republican converts still speak fondly of Reagan.
Sure. Well, and now they're
glowingly fondly,
and they're rehabilitating Bush and all that. And I don't doubt that at some point in the near future, history books will be literally printing Trump's propaganda and saying Trump's inauguration was the biggest attended inauguration in American history. And they will be just uncritically echoing those things, and they will have made him squeaky clean. But the record will be there. And if you look at the Wikipedia page and read it, you'll be saying, wow, an awful lot of people were convicted of money laundering and
various crimes,
failing to register as a foreign agent and all this. But there's such a, there's actually a real simple explanation for an awful lot of this, which I've talked about before, which is basically, as Trump's campaign got underway, he just reached into his network.
Oh, yeah.
And his network is full of petty criminals and you know, quasi-traitorous, you know, people who, you know, fixers and whatnot.
Right.
And they all like, hey, here's an opportunity to make some money.
Okay.
And here's the twist to it.
Right.
None of them thought he would win.
Precisely.
And so they're like, yeah, let's just grift as much as we can out of this shit. You know, we'll learn as much as we can. We'll run as many scams as we can on it. And, you know, since he's going to lose, no one will be looking at the books that closely.
Right. It's not going
to
be a
thing. Right. Right. And it was a shock to Trump, and it was a shock to all these campaign people that he won.
Well, I think it was. I will say this, however, because of the nature of his win.
Yes.
Someone was clearly...
Right. Playing the electrical.
The electrical college.
Playing the electoral college. Knew what they were... Had a strategy right. there.
Someone had a clear, rational strategy for winning.
I don't know who that was.
I don't think it was 45 himself. But no. Someone puling strings.
Right.
Had a clear, rational strategy.
In a way that they clearly didn't with Clinton's campaign.
Didn't
right?
have like a clear rational strategy.
But a lot of the big grift and whatnot that went on with these, you know, campaign associates and whatnot happened early on.
Right.
And so they really were unconvinced back then.
Oh, yeah. Like,
Trump was going to win.
Like in 2015.
Right.
Like
so they were like, we can just do whatever the
good.
Hell we want.
We'll do
just,
what you like. You know,
because this is going to all sink like a stone from the public eye.
You know? Then, you know, no one's going to be interested or care.
Stone. Roger Stone.
Anyway. Oh. So, anyway. Yeah.
Okay.
Where are we?
Where are we? That's a good question. So, we've finished our introduction here, our introductory remarks. Now let's get on to the
let's get on to the meat
topic.
Of the show. Yeah.
So we don't the meat of the show this week is we don't really have a lot of meat, and we didn't prepare reading articles or whatnot.
Oh, this is a vegetarian episode?
Yeah, this is a vegetarian episode. Actually, we just had a vegetarian dinner.
That was so good.
Your friend had an open house, and she had a ton of food left over.
Yes.
And you were there, and she said, take some of this food, please.
Don't leave without food.
And so you brought home like a tray of fettuccine salad and mishatara
and some just fresh cut melon.
Some melon. And it was a terrific light meal.
It was a great meal.
Yeah.
A great summer meal for a hot day.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we're very satisfied with that.
Yeah.
But we don't really have a topic as far as a political topic tonight.
No, we don't.
We're catching up a little bit on current events. But I also said, why don't we just catch up on some of the media stuff?
Oh, yeah.
So this is mostly me. It's mostly stuff from my blog. It's this thing that I do because you're not reading a lot of fiction or...
No, I'm not reading a terrible lot. I'm basically... You know what I'm reading? I'm reading recipe books to plan Thanksgiving dinner. That's
already?
What I'm reading. Yep.
Now?
Yep.
Good for you.
Hey, you know.
Yeah. Well, we're growing some pumpkins, right?
Growing some pumpkins. I was a Girl Scout. I try to think ahead.
Yes. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about stuff I've been reading and watching, and you won't have a huge amount to say, but feel free to jump in if you have
it. I'll jump in as needed. You know, I'll make obnoxious remarks as the moment calls for it.
So I picked up earlier in the year, I bought a set of 7 books by Michael Moorcock that basically represent the whole... all the Elric stories.
Right.
And this is his most famous character.
Oh, yeah. We've talked a bit about these books before.
Yeah. We introduced him before. I have finished the first 6.
Wow.
Yeah. They're not really that long.
They're not long and dense.
They're padded. So the padded, they're like, most of them are... Like, there's a novel, which is really a fix-up, which is padded out with a few extra stories and an intro and outro essays.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't really that long. But the books are Elric Stormbringer, Elric the Sailor on the Seas of Fate, Elric the Sleeping Sorceress and Other Stories, Elric the Revenge of the Rose, Elric of Melnibone and Other Stories, Elric the Fortress of the Pearl. And these editions they're British editions, Golanx.
Mm-hmm.
And they're nice, colorful books. They're well-made paperbacks. Yeah. They look nice on the shelf. In this set, Moorcock rearranged all the Elric material in internal chronological order, like story order.
Story order. Like, this is the first thing that happened in the story.
Right.
It's not there. Oh, right. Yeah. So you talked about this before, about how it's not in release date order.
Right.
And how you just basically decided to go back and read it in release date order.
Yeah. 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 I read this stuff and decided that it's not actually fun to try and read it in story chronology.
No, his more exciting stuff was first, written first.
Yeah, so I'll talk
although about I think that. You opened up something else though about like the order.
Yeah.
Like there's a good chunk first and then there's another good chunk later.
Yeah. Right. I'll mention that. But so I actually would recommend that if you want to get into the Elric stuff, start like this. Read these things in publication order.
Right.
And his stories go back to 1962, I think. They were like, it's been a while, right?
Yeah, it's been a while.
And he was very young when he published some of these, like, I think he was 18 or 19. Mm-hmm. The Dreaming City, a novella, While the Gods Laugh, The Stealer of Souls, Kings in Darkness. These are all short works. The Caravan of Forgotten Dreams, a.k.a. The Flamebringers. Mm-hmm. And then Stormbringer, which is a novel, but it's also a fix-up, so it's also put together out of several novellas. Mm-hmm. And then that basically is the end of the Elric story. And spoiler, you know, he dies at the end of that arc.
Oh, yeah.
Right. At the end of Stormbringer. Mm-hmm. But there are a few more stories that I would highly recommend reading after that. One is called The Singing Citadel. And then one called The Eternal Champion, which is a great novella. Mm-hmm. And then the novel Elric of Melniboné, which is his like origin story.
Right.
And then a funny story called The Stone Thing.
It's a naughty, sturdy.
A naughty
story. Yeah, it's a naughty story.
It's really funny. So, and then I would honestly just stop there. And the stuff that I've, that list, these are all short works. Mm-hmm. So... they're scattered throughout this like six volumes that I described, or you could just get, there's a Del Rey edition called The Chronicles of the Last Emperor of Melniboné. Mm-hmm. And the first one is called Elric, the Stealer of Souls, Del Rey, 2008, and Elric to Rescue Tanalorn is the next one. Mm-hmm. And, those two books will give you everything on that short list and a little more in publication order. Mm-hmm. And then for Elric of Melniboné, just pick up a used paperback or something, or the third book, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't recommend the novels. So he did all these early novellas. Mm-hmm. And then during the 70s and 80s, he pieced together a number of stories and rewrote them and reassembled them and created some novels. And most of them aren't very good.
Oh.
Which is disappointing.
That's disappointing, yeah.
So, I mean, you could consider reading The Sailor on the Seas of Fate. I don't really recommend it. You could consider The Sleeping Sorceress. I don't really recommend it. You could consider The Fortress of the Pearl, I really don't recommend that one. or The Revenge of the Rose. They're just not that good.
Yeah.
But then, quite a few years later, he wrote a trilogy of novels. These are fairly recent, called The Moonbeam Roads. Mm-hmm. And
it's been recent, like 20 years, 10 years?
Yeah, like 10 years. Like,
oh, okay, so like the 2000s.
Yeah. I think. So I'm reading the first one of the Moonbeam Roads novels. There's an omnibus volume. It's a big fat book with three novels in it. And these are not fix-ups. They weren't pieced together from novellas, and they're full-length novels.
Right.
But he still used the exact same structure. Like, they're three parts each, and each part has seven chapters.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
So he really likes that structure, I guess.
It just feels good.
It works pretty well. The first one is called Daughter of Dreams. And this one, his style in this, he's brought Elric into like our world.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And this all has to do with the multiverse stuff and parallel universes and all this.
That's why it feels like the 2000s, because that was a thing. It was in the air.
Right, right. Originally published as The Dream Thief's Daughter, and it has a complicated relationship to the earlier stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
So things, I had notes in my blog, all this stuff is in my blog, and I'll link to it. things started going very magical. It's actually set during the run-up to the Holocaust.
Oh.
With a character known as Von Beck, who inhabits a big old castle in Germany. And mm-hmm. it turns out is a sort of avatar of Elric in our world. And is actually... his Nazi superiors have...
Of course
he's
a Nazi, right?
He's not a Nazi.
He's not a Nazi.
But the officials are trying to recruit him.
Right.
And they're trying to pressure him because they believe that his family has both an ancient sword, which is an avatar of Stormbringer, mm-hmm. and the little thing we like to call the Holy Grail.
It's like that. Okay.
It's like that. And it's sort of...
It's a little Indiana Jones.
It's a little Indiana Jones. It's sort of tied into all this Grail lore and Nazis on the moon kind of, you know, stuff. But the first part is really quite gritty because he's like mm-hmm. taken to a detention facility and beaten, and his roommate hangs himself, and it's pretty graphic. And,
oh, God. That sounds awful.
But... then it sort of slips really gradually and smoothly into a magical
realism
realm. So mm-hmm. He travels into sort of a parallel underground Earth realm, mm-hmm. and it's a little bit like Pellucidar, the Edgar Rice Burroughs stories about a hollow Earth.
Right,
and it's. It makes reference to Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth. And mm-hmm. it's sort of suggested that this is part of the lost continent of Mu, which is a whole other genre of ancient Atlantis sort of fiction.
Oh, yeah.
And then he manages to travel into a world where he keeps seeing Elric. And mm-hmm. we sort of discover that he is... actually like a dream of Elric, and then it becomes unclear for a while whether his existence he's dreaming Elric or Elric is dreaming him. And it becomes quite
wait, does the story ever answer that question?
Well, there's from the it answers it from the perspective of the different characters. Right,
are the answers the same?
Well, no.
And, okay. All right.
But this is kind of how the multiverse works. So, like, it from one perspective,
right?
Elric is lying on he's unconscious in mm-hmm. his realm,
right?
In Tantalorn, and he's dreaming of traveling to find Von Beck to come and help him.
Right.
Von Beck then joins with him and sort of wakes up as. He wakes up as Von Beck. Von Beck then has some adventures and then eventually comes back and finds Elric's like sleeping body
mm-hmm.
and like gives him his sword, which wakes him up. And then now the perspective shifts and he's in Elric's body, you know?
Okay.
So it's confusing in that way, but it really is like a manifestation of this Zen idea, you know, Zen master wakes up and says he couldn't tell if he was a Zen master dreaming that he was a butterfly or a butterfly now dreaming that he's a Zen master. It is literally a manifestation of that
of
kind
that
of logic, right?
All right.
But it's, yeah, so the second part kind of drifts along a little bit confusing through, magical realms and coincidences and all this, and I didn't find the second part that compelling because it's all a lot of multiverse crap, which is pretty but not really great engaging storytelling.
Yeah, that's what happens for me is I need the story to be a little more concrete and resolved.
Yeah, it picks up in the third act, right? And now there's like there's fight scenes again and stuff happening and, mm-hmm. you know, so, and we're back with, but it's interesting to see Elric through the lens of a human character from our own world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because we've spent, I've spent a long time reading about Elric as the protagonist, describing everything from his perspective. Like, what would it be like to meet Elric? You know,
right?
And he's pretty terrifying. Mm-hmm. And Stormbringer is pretty terrifying from a human perspective. Right. And it's cool to see that.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to talk briefly about the nature of inspiration and sort of the way an artist's career might function. And then I think we'll wind up for today, because everyone will be ready to doze off. So, nature of inspiration and early work versus late work.
Mm-hmm.
So I've come to think of the early Elric stories written by a very young Moorcock as like genuinely inspired work.
Yeah.
Written, Nabokov used to say there's only one way to write, and that's ecstatically, like just in a rush of inspiration. He was written under the influence of the genre and the language, and Nabokov was too. But and that's one way to write great work, in like a blast of youthful energy and inspiration.
Yeah.
But it's not the only way, right?
No.
One can also revise a great work into existence. That can happen. Mm-hmm. Outlining it and drafting it and diligently working on it and reworking until it's really polished and good. And it might not have as much of the raw exuberance as the first kind of work, but it can still be very, very satisfying, if not more satisfying. And I think like a novel like Middlemarch, you know, was written that way, right? Over a long period of time, carefully worked out.
Carefully planned, executed, revised, right.
What doesn't seem to work well is trying to write in a hot blast of inspiration after the inspiration has left.
But there is no inspiration.
Yeah.
Just, so, you know, going on steam.
Papers. Moorcock's mid-career, and he had a mid-career that lasted for decades. he was also a very successful editor, I should mention, too.
Oh, right. He was,
but
yeah,
we're talking about his fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of fell into this hole. He wrote these works quickly for money, and the inspiration that used to let him write so quickly tended to peter out, and he would brag about it and write articles about how he could write and finish a novel in 3 days, right?
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, you need to have an outline and you need to have some ideas and some tropes you're going to go to, and then you need a lot of coffee and a lot of whiskey or something like that. Yeah. And so an awful lot of his novels aren't that good.
Oh, yeah.
Because he didn't really have time to revise them into polish, and he wasn't really inspired to do this, like, this blast of youthful energy.
Inspiration, yeah.
And I related this in my blog to Phil Dick, because I don't think Phil Dick ever really developed a late style.
Right, where he would kind of write an outline,
right,
come up with a structure, and kind of carve this thing out of wood, right?
For whatever reasons, and I've read some biographies of him, from drugs to mental illness to physical illness, Dick continued to work like he did when he was very young. He wrote in binges,
right,
even when the ideas actually demanded more serious and sustained treatment. And some of his greatest works, like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, they're kind of hot messes.
Yeah.
Because he didn't revise things into coherence.
Right.
But they're stuffed with so many brilliant ideas.
People can't put it down.
That you can't put it down. But they're riddled with...
But it doesn't actually make a lot of sense.
No, they're riddled with inconsistent timelines, internal inconsistencies, and whatnot. In the case of Androids, this actually makes the work feel more hallucinatory. Because you question, as you're reading it, and like the timeline changes and the facts change and whatnot, and you can't establish like what really happened when, you start to question whether you're fully...
Am I reading this right?
Or whether your brain is betraying you or something.
Right.
But I do have no doubt that if Dick had developed like a really diligent, regular approach to writing, he could have revised Androids into something that was razor sharp, you know, that was
Something really, well, not that it's not compelling.
Yeah.
But something really amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Daughter of Dreams is in what I would call Moorcock's late style. Mm-hmm. He deliberately and consciously attempted to bring his oeuvre into a single intricate pattern. So he's been applying this multiverse concept to all his old works. And this includes going back and changing characters. Like, this character, I'm giving him a new name and he's actually an avatar of the Eternal Champion. Rather than, like,
right.
changing events, making all these connections between his old books. Mm-hmm. So
that's a little, what's his name? You know, he screwed up the Star Wars thing.
Oh, yeah.
With the whole retconning. You know?
I'm not...
It's a little George like Lucas, yeah. Lucas, yeah. I was going to say Spielberg, no, Lucas.
No, I'm not really happy about that.
Yeah.
And a lot of that stuff does not entice me to want to read a lot of his sort of mid-catalog novels.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I don't think it's really worthwhile. I don't think readers... I think he's indulging himself. In other words, yes. I don't think readers were begging him, please make this all into one giant ball of yarn.
Wouldn't that be great?
I don't think it's really great.
No one's jonesing for it.
But anyway, despite that, because this is written in his late style and it is inspired by his early work and mm-hmm. his character, it's pretty good. And so I'm going to recommend that people would read Daughter of Dreams. So you would read all the early work. You would basically skip over, I call it, kind of the whole mid-career Elric stuff, unless you really want to.
You just want your completist. You got to read it all.
Yeah. But read it in publication order and not internal chronology order. Right. So don't get the Golanx books.
As nice as they are.
As nice as they are, as pretty a set it is, because if you do that, you'll have to print out a list and be jumping around.
It'll be stupid.
It's hard. And if you do read them in chronological, like internal chronology order, it's not that fun. It's confusing. And you're immediately turned off by some of the mid-career novels that are bad and boring. So rather than being like racing through all those early novellas that are really tight and really inspiring, you'll be immediately bogged down in mediocre storytelling.
Right, and be turned off to the whole thing.
Yeah. So at least that's my conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a... Edward Said had a book called On Late Style.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a quote from Edward Rothstein writing in the New York Review of Books in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
What artist does not yearn someday to possess a late style? A late style would reflect a life of learning, the wisdom that comes with experience, the sadness that comes from wisdom and a mastery of craft that has nothing left to prove. Right. It might recapitulate a life's themes, reflect on questions answered, and allude to others beyond understanding. But even if that kind of culminating style is not granted to an artist, observers want to discern it. We want to be reassured that there really is something progressive about human understanding.
Hmm. Hmm.
So, yes, we want to believe that there's an arc to Moorcock's career.
We're getting somewhere.
And I think there is.
You've established
hidden.
It. Yeah,
right. But we all would like to have an arc, you know.
Right.
I keep writing and I keep hoping that I'm getting somewhere with this.
Well, you know, you're starting to make improvements.
And that there will be a discernible arc to it, you know, at some point when I'm gone, if someone wants to
page through
and make sense of all this, I'll have a late style. There will be an arc, you know. And so I guess that's sort of what I'm trying to do now, is find that. And then, of course, just also figure out, what am I writing? Am I writing fiction, autobiography, nonfiction, criticism, essays, or what?
All the above.
That's a
good question.
Anyway. That's my recommendation for dealing with the Elric stories. I'm not even quite done with Daughter of Dreams, but I'm going to go ahead and recommend it. But I really do recommend that people read, if you're at all interested in this kind of fantasy, go ahead and read the old stuff first and read it in the order that I've outlined, and then consider mm-hmm. reading the new trilogy.
The new trilogy.
Yeah. And I can't, honestly, I can't, at least Daughter of Dreams, I can't vouch for the second and third one. I think they kind of crawl up their own butts a little bit.
Yeah, there's that.
But, okay.
I think we're there.
I think we're there.
Yeah.
We were not bursting with inspiration ourselves, but rather just trying to
show up,
crank out a novel in 3 days, armed with whiskey and caffeine.
There's no whiskey or caffeine involved, to be honest.
No, there wasn't.
But we wanted to show up.
We wanted to show up, so here we are. You've been listening to the Grace and Paul Podcast. Check out the show blog at podcast.blogspot.com, where you can leave comments or search for the Grace and Paul Podcast on Facebook or YouTube.
Bye-bye.
Bye.